session number 9876, reel 4.
Mr. Dennis, reel 4. You were telling me how you came to join the Inns of Court OTC. If you could explain how you got in and how you got through the problem of your eyesight.
Yes. I went to a hall where applicants were being accepted or not for the Inns of Court OTC, and I found a very large queue doing the medical examination, or waiting for the medical examination. At the top end of the queue, there was a sergeant, and beyond him was one of those arrangements that you test eyesight with, cards with bigger and smaller letters on that can be turned by electricity, so that it will show a different card. As I moved up the queue, I saw that when the large letters, which I could read without glasses, appeared at the bottom of the arrangement, the smaller letters above were always the same. For instance, if you saw BZ appear, which I could see, then from memory I could tell that it was AKYFW. And so I kept paid careful attention to this, memorizing the small letters, till I got to the top of the queue and was able to read well enough to pass. So, in spite of my bad eyesight, I was accepted. Ironically, I spent most of the war, all my active service in France, largely as a forward observing officer in the artillery, using, of course, my glasses. And I noticed with interest that when you saw any German prisoners, about half of them appeared to be wearing glasses. In fact, we had a totally obsolete requirement for eyesight. Well, I got in.
Were there any other examinations or tests?
Oh, yes. Usual medical examination. You know, you coughed and all this kind of thing, the usual thing. Not very detailed. I'm sure a certain number of people passed who shouldn't have passed, but they listen to your heart, they listen to your lungs and so on. They took your blood pressure in a crude way.
This was in
January 1916.
And what exactly were you joining as?
I was joining as a private. You could only join as a private, and that's what I was. The Corps, the Inns of Court, had its headquarters at Berkhamsted, but they had got the headquarters full. They had so many recruits. So the rest of us were told to live wherever we liked in London, and to appear every morning at Lincoln's Inn Fields. There we were drilled by an ex-sergeant major of the guards. And of course there was nothing, we had no weapons. There was no sensible drill we could possibly do. So it was square bashing. We did every form of square bashing you can imagine, including such things as the slow march at funerals. prudishness of that kind. It's all he could do with us. I suppose it had the effect of making us answer quickly to the word of command, but not much else. Then they decided we would do something else. So we should assemble at a place on Hampstead Heath every morning. And there we used to march about in enormous bodies, perhaps 500 or 1,000 strong, over Hampstead Heath in serried ranks, very suitable perhaps for the Marlborough Wars or the Napoleonic Wars, but nothing to do with 1914-18. This went on, this pointless but not unpleasant life, because off duty we could do what we liked, and it was quite fun.
Did you live at home?
My father was, of course, at the front. My mother was in a hotel in South Kensington, and I lived there.
How did you react to your first taste of the real sort of army life?
I didn't mind it. I don't want to go on record as saying this, but I sometimes said that the Western Front was nothing to my public school. It was a jam. But still, I found army life in the ranks very often boring, but not unpleasant. I think I was more frightened of generals than I was of Germans, and that lasted throughout the war, I think.
You didn't mind the discipline and the lack of privacy. That's what
I did. Well, the lack of privacy was something I was, as a public school boy, it meant nothing to me. Lack of privacy, discipline. Well, I'd had plenty of discipline in my time, and it wasn't harsh. You might be. I was once or twice put on a charge. Once I was issued with a defective. With a pair of spurs, this was later, that were defective. And I used to be, when I was inspected, I used to be charged with dirty spurs because I couldn't get the mark out of the metal. And I thought that was a little unfair, but it only happened twice.
How long were you training at Lincoln Inn Fields and at Hampstead Heath?
Oh, not more than a few weeks.
And that's all you did, drill?
That's all we did, drill without arms. No arms.
And what happened then?
The War Office sent a major to interview privates in the Officers' Training Corps, OTC, with a view to finding chaps who would be capable of being taught how to act as subalterns in heavy batteries. Now, as you probably know very well, we came into the war with no heavy artillery. The Marines had a few huge howitzers. The Royal Garrison Artillery had fixed guns at ports and fortresses, and the field artillery was quite good. But we had no medium siege guns. And we were getting shelled in France out of all knowledge by the Germans, and our authorities were busy forming siege guns and issuing them. And of course, the guns themselves were lacking. So though they started us, I'm anticipating things. The major, who was interviewing, asked me what I had done, and I told him that I'd been a classical scholar, and that I'd got a scholarship, but not taken it up. And he said, "Know any mathematics?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Doesn't matter, you'll learn enough." And in fact, the mathematics required for the job of the Royal Garrison Artillery were easily learned by anybody. There was nothing mystical about it.
Did he ask you about anything else to test your suitability?
I think he must have done, but I can't remember any other questions. I think he must have done. But he was looking for people to form the new siege batteries, and I was chosen, only there was not any really clear division between people being trained for the commissions in the Royal Field Artillery and people being trained for commissions in the Royal Garrison Artillery, which manned all the siege guns. So the result was that in my training I had some quite ridiculous horse law inculcated. I had some very unpleasant, very short time, but very unpleasant weeks when I was at a remount depot where they had...
We'll come to that later. Where were you sent first? After this major had interviewed you, what was the next thing? Did he tell you you'd passed or been accepted? Or?
I think he gave me the impression I had. But I don't. I think I think all I got was summons to the orderly room, and told to get my kit together and go to Weymouth, where they had turned the soldiers, the sailors' home, into a small cadet school.
Did the cadet school have a name, or was it a unit, or did?
I don't remember. I only remember it as the Weymouth RGA Cadet School.
And how many of you were, was this new intake?
I can't remember more than three or four of us who went to Weymouth together. Weymouth was really a very slack cadet school. It was. We were very humanely treated. The officer in charge was an old RGA soak, one of these people who had spent his military career in fortresses in Malta, places like that, and he had an enormous capacity for drink, which he could imbibe without visible effect. And provided we behaved reasonably, we were not harried. But we weren't able to learn much because we needed a gun. And we hadn't any guns that were produced, they were of course houses really, were needed urgently at the front. And so all we had, there's a funny old gun that may have been used in the Napoleonic Wars and perhaps the Boer War, that whose mechanism was nothing like what we were going to deal with. We used to stand around it and go through motions.
What sort of thing did they try and teach you? Or what did you get taught?
Well, we had, of course, lectures on this and that. I don't remember any specific gunnery lectures, though there may have been, but in general we were really, I think, being taught to be soldiers more than anything else, more than anything specific.
What did that involve?
Jumping to it if you got ordered to do something, looking smart when you were going to be seen by somebody, and the various dodges that exist in the army for avoiding excessive work and so on.
Did they lecture you in the mathematics and theory of gunnery?
No. I don't remember that ever happening. But I must have picked this up somewhere. I don't remember lectures, but they gave us books or something. At any rate, I was not entirely devoid of knowledge. They were pretty basic, pretty rudimentary.
Did they do anything to teach you the power of command or the social niceties?
Well, not. They didn't set out to teach you that, but a chap would be picked out and say, "Look, you're commanding these the rest of these chaps. We want them over there, the other side of the town, in order, quickly." And you had to do this kind of thing. You learnt it that way, but not. They didn't kind of set out to with any theory behind them.
Did they?
Or practice.
Did they take any effort to teach you sort of the basic skills of shooting a normal rifle or
not
a revolver?
Not till then. Rifles, no, I don't remember. I don't remember them at all. Later on, of course, we did get taught. Only in between the rest of my time in England, and my time I was a gunner, you see. I've been a private in the OTC. I was a gunner at the cadet school. And then I was commissioned. But I was, of course, very young. And I think because I was very young, I and a number of other people, all of whom were also very young, were not sent to batteries in France, but kept at home at cadet schools, acting as, well, they called us instructors, but we weren't capable of instructing. What we really were, dog spotters. We used to do the orderly officer business and go and see that the food was all right and examine the swill bins and
How long did you stay at, before we move on too much to that,
yes.
How long did you stay at Weymouth before you moved, I think you went on to Trowbridge then?
Yes, you know, I'm afraid here I must confess ignorance, I don't remember. I wasn't at Weymouth very long, and nor was I at Trowbridge very long.
Is that where you had the course in horse riding?
Certainly wasn't at Weymouth. It was after I left Weymouth sometime. But whether it was between Weymouth and Trowbridge that I was at that remount depot, I wasn't there for very long.
You didn't like, you said you mentioned earlier you didn't like your time at the remount depot.
I knew nothing about horses. And as far as I could see, most of these were vicious horses that had been rejected from horse units, and they were no fun to deal with. I got kicked and not badly, and stood on, that is more painful, and barged into the side of the stall. That's another trick bad horses would have got. I did some very rudimentary riding, but practically none. I used to have to get up and hours like 5 o'clock in the morning and muck out the stables. That was a cold, filthy, disgusting job. But I think I would have disliked it less if I had had any background of knowledge of horses, but I had none.
Did you see it as an irrelevance?
Purely, it was for no good at all. I was going to join a battery that was whose guns were drawn by tractors. So it was a pure waste of time and money. And it was due to the fact that they got jammed up with the at Trowbridge, say, with it. They filled all the places and they had to do something. I think that's how I got to this place. They had to do something with us. And that's how I think I got sent to the remount depot.
Do you remember where it was?
No.
Now, at Trowbridge, what were you meant? What was it? This was another cadet school.
Trowbridge was another and much better run cadet school where the officer instructors knew their job all right. Only, of course, their knowledge was conventional gunners, conventional gunnery, which was not what happened in France, as I tell you later on. But I wouldn't say that the Trowbridge place was a dead loss.
What sort of things do they try and teach you there?
Well, they tried to teach us as far as possible things that would be useful to us as gunners. For instance, to give one example, they had some cut down breeches of 6-inch howitzers, and the sergeant instructor used to sit on the breech, and they had solid shot weighing 100 pounds, and you had to go in succession holding this shot and putting it into a tray and pushing it forward into the breech, and every now and again the sergeant in charge used to upset the shot, because that was the thing you had to learn what to do when a shell was dropped. Of course, what you did do was to leap high in the air before the thing got you on the foot. I remember this as being one of the things that they taught us. But of course, we didn't learn very much. I think at Trowbridge, certainly, we must have had some lectures showing us such things as lines of sight and how the guns were aimed. And I'm sure they did that, because I must have learnt it somewhere.
Now, how did you getting more and more experience, so to speak. You were still just a normal gunner.
I was still I know. In between this, I was commissioned.
So you were now commissioned.
And I was a subaltern, second lieutenant. And my job was to assist at Trowbridge. You see, I was never a gunner at Trowbridge. I was a subaltern.
So this was when you'd moved on into your phase of being an assistant.
Yes.
Dog's body.
Yes.
Right.
Very much a dog's body. And all the kind of unromantic side of army life was there. I mean, you had to go around and see whether the latrines were all right and report, get the sergeant into trouble if they weren't, that sort of thing.
Did you mind being a dog's body? I mean, did you think
no.
The war would be...
No, I thought to myself, you're in this, in the army, and when you're in the army, this is the sort of thing that happens. So I didn't mind. Only I did want... The thing that did get me down, rather, was that I knew I was in the army for the purpose of fighting Germans and not inspecting latrines in England. And I did want to get to the front. And I used at intervals to ask my current commanding officer if he could put my name forward for going to an active service unit. And he used to say, well, yes, I quite sympathize. I'm sure you must want that. I'll send your name forward. And so he did, and nothing happened. And at last I got a At last I got an order. Now this must have been 1916, I think, or early in 1917, that I was to go with reinforcements to a battery abroad. But first of all, I remember we were taken to Lydd and we did some actual firing of guns there.
Now, how does Liverpool fit into that? Because I know you were...
Oh, yes. Well, that was later. At Liverpool...
Well, oh, sorry, that's later. I'll yes. So you went to
Liverpool. Liverpool came early in 1917. I wasn't there. It was after the Battle of Arras, I think, which was April. At Liverpool, they were forming, they were assembling reinforcements for batteries, which were short of men in France and Belgium. The bases and the services and so on were all provided by the fortress establishment. There were long-range guns in the dunes outside Liverpool. Great Crosby was my battery. I had nothing to do with those guns, of course, because at least they didn't waste the time. It would have been a pure waste of time to give us anything to do with the fixed guns. They're not the same.
So how... Now, you'd been assigned to go to France, and you'd gone to Lydd for this fleet,
yes.
Right? How did you come to go to Liverpool?
Liverpool first, I think. I think that was where I was given about 50 men or a bit more who I was told were going to be the reinforcements I was going to take to France.
Now, while you were at Liverpool, I know in our previous talk you mentioned that you didn't think much of the officers who
I
were
did
running
not.
It. Could you tell me what you disliked about
what
them?
What I disliked about them was that I thought that they had discovered a means of avoiding active service so as to live in comfortable conditions, because they only spent a certain amount of time in the forts and they had plenty of time in Liverpool, and because they used to use these officers like myself who were being prepared for abroad to do all the work in the forts, all the orderly officer jobs and all that, and they were not pleasant to us, and I think they may have sensed the fact that we had no use for them. As I say, there was one exception. There was a man, a rather elderly subaltern, who was Jewish and much more human. And I remember him with considerable affection, and but no other person in the Liverpool establishment was any good to me. Only this man. I think I'm digressing too much here, but he invited one of the English subalterns who was being got ready for France to come to a bar mitzvah festival of his, and the chap told me afterwards he enjoyed himself very much. However, that's all terribly off work.
You'd heard from your father about what life was really like on the Western Front.
Well,
why were you so keen to get out there?
Because I couldn't see any point in being in the war unless I was actively in it. It seemed quite useless to be hulling about in England doing stupid and or silly jobs when there was a war going on. It seemed stupid.
So the day came and you were...
The day came, finally, when at last I was in Liverpool. And I was... Now, I think Lyd then came. I think we just went for a night or two to Lyd on the way to France. But, you know, my memory is not right on this. I can only remember that we fired some actual howitzers at Lyd and didn't hit anything at all. And that the next thing I found myself was